everybody. Welcome to episode 109 of Not a Robot Podcast's DC Comics review show. Since Rob is busy with some moving this week, it's just Josh and I hosting for this episode, but we'll do our very best to keep you all entertained. As usual, we'll be covering the latest books from DC, and we hope you enjoy it. Make sure you stick around until the end of this episode to hear our top three books of the week, the biggest stinker, and to find out which titles might just make the dump list. If you would like to support us further, please visit buymeacoffee.com/NAR podcasts for either a one-time donation or subscription for access to our Discord, as well as other exclusive content available on the network. But with that out of the way, let's get into some news. Josh, I'm going to pass it over to you. What do you got for news this week?
I have none other than just personal news between you and I. And that's I've managed to dig up all of the issues of the DC Ghosts annual. And I'm all ready to get them shared with you. As far as any other kind of news this week, I have absolutely nothing.
Well, if that's the case, I don't really have all that much either. It was kind of a slow week. I feel like everything major was last week, just some minor stuff. We got our first look at the Worlds Without a Justice League, Wonder Woman number one, one shot that will be coming from Teenie Howard and Layla Del Luca. Some preview images were released over on Adventures in Poor Taste that very well illustrated, but we'll have to wait and see if the story is up there with the art as well. And then, because I wouldn't be me if I didn't do it, but I have to, gotta plug the Best Jacket Press books. They're out as of yesterday, some of the newer releases. Canary number two is out. I believe Dudley Datson number two is out. And I'm blanking on the third one, I think, because I haven't read that one.
Me too.
I think that's Barnstormers. I'm pretty sure it's Barnstormers,
yes. Yep.
Tula Lote. So Canary, Barnstormers, and Dudley Datson are part of the second wave. I'm
going to convince, I haven't read issue one out of any of them, but I want to.
Yeah. I've read Canary, which was really good, and I have not finished Barnstormers yet, but I was enjoying it so far. It felt very much in Snyder's alley. He seems to have a strange affinity for that early 1910s period of America. So it kind of takes place during then, 1910s and 1920s. Those are all available over on Comixology if you want to check it out. If you also have an Amazon Prime account, you can read it for free. They're definitely worth your time. You know, they're great digital reads that will be coming to print sometime in the near future. We actually just got the announcement that Night of the Ghoul is coming to print as a 3-issue oversized series. So don't worry for the print freaks like me. We'll get our hands on them in print. But right now you can read them over on Comixology. So that's all I have, really.
I completely forgot about the Snyder books, man. Dang it.
Yeah,
I'm gonna have to go check out Wave 2.
It's a lot of good stuff. And there's more stuff in the pipeline, so definitely looking forward to that.
Hell yeah. Speaking of some good stuff, let me just go ahead and jump into my mentions that I do at the beginning of every show. First, Harley Quinn number 21, man. Task Force XX has been quite the ride. Luke Fox's got a new costume, no bat symbol, but no new name yet either. I always thought Batwing was kind of dumb because that was the name of his plane for so long. But so that's going on. That's going to wrap up in Harley Quinn's annual, be there or be square. Batman Fortress number four. Another Batman book was the last thing that we needed. But this story has turned out to be pretty interesting, if not a little different. And with Derek Robertson, most of the art is going to be great, even with those thick ass lines. Tales of the Human Target number one. It collects King's Human Target run. This is probably the best way to read it.
It's a separate one shot.
Oh, are you serious?
Yeah, I think you might have mistakenly read the trade. Yeah, no, Tales of the Human Target, separate one shot featuring three different artists, Mikael Hanin, Rafael Albuquerque, and Kevin Maguire. I was very excited to see doing more DC stuff again, is just a series of tales featuring the Human Target, all related to some of the people that he's interviewed so far. So that's Booster Gold, Blue Beetle, and Fire.
Well, that is cool as shit. I assumed it was just the trade. I thought that's what this was just the trade. So I will have to go and read that then. I just had it on here. This is probably the best way to read it in trade form, because I haven't checked it out yet. Now I have a reason to.
Batman. It's pretty solid.
Right on. Batman, White Knights. Before I go on, this is probably the only thing in modern time that Tom King has done that I love. It's been a little iffy, but Human Target has been so solid. I really enjoy it. So go out there and read that shit. Batman White Knight presents Red Hood number 2. It was somewhat predictable in spots, but it was still pretty damn good. It would probably be in the main reviews or at least in the spotlights if we didn't have so many books and we weren't down one person. DC Mech number 2. I like the story. It's fun. It's like reading a really good Saturday morning cartoon. Baldemar Rivas draws a little bit too much like Rosmo for my taste, especially with a lot of the faces, but you guys out there might like that. Overall, it is a pretty fun read. Fables 154, read it. Always read Fables. And finally, Justice League versus Legion of Superheroes number 5. Skip it. A short issue this month, I think, compared to what we normally get, and that was really the only thing that's been good about it, other than the absolutely flawless art. And that is all the mentioning that I want to do before we dive into the spotlight, dude.
Yeah, very cool. Well, then in that case, we'll turn on our spotlight and we'll shift our attention over to the first book this week, certainly one that needs no introduction, and that is The Swamp Thing number 16, which is our final issue of the series. I know, so sad.
I'm sure
we'll get a sequel or something someday. I'm holding out hope. I don't think this is the end, especially with the way that this story ended. But that is, of course, brought to us by our all-star team, who also need no introduction at this point, but we'll give it anyway. Ram V, with art from Mike Perkins, colors from Mike Spicer, and letters from Aditya Bidikar. Trinity presents her case to the Parliament of Gears, showing both the good and the bad, but attempting to sympathize with the Parliament as a fellow product of human engineering. Ultimately, however, she realizes that she has yet to make her choice on being a creature of joy or of final consequence. Levi argues that it is this very idea, the idea of choice, that should define the Parliament, rather than wanton violence and war. The Pale Wanderer refuses this sophistry and charges at Levi to end this ridiculous debate. Levi, knowing what happens when two ideas clash, finally puts an end to the Wanderer, burying him in a large tree once again. He knows the Wanderer will return, but he will stand watch, ready for the next time. Following this, Levi and Jennifer make a trip to the forests of Kaziranga, which Levi can appreciate in a whole new light. It seems that peace is finally the future for him, but Jason Woodrue decides to haunt him at that very moment, informing him that he has only delayed the inevitable. Humanity's stubborn nature will surely create conflict with the elemental forces again, and Levi will have to come to grips with that. Levi, in a rather somber ending, tells him that he knows this and does not deny it, but informs Woodrue that all that matters in the end, or all that matters, is the choice in the end. His grand ambitions are not as large as others, and all he really wishes is to be a man that he is proud to look at in the mirror each day. And he walks off, concluding this chapter of The Swamp Thing. Okay. It was a decent ending, but if I'm being entirely honest, it was really rushed. There were a number of plot lines and emotional beats that just felt unresolved, and the series really could have benefited from a double-sized final issue or an additional issue to serve as a coda. Some of the missing resolutions that should have been in the finale that would have made this ending really cathartic were a final scene acknowledging Levi and Jacob's restored relationship, and that was the one that I found the most disappointing, because Levi and Jacob in the previous issue had finally come to an understanding, and Jacob had worked to restore the green. And then we never see him again. We never get that final closing chapter on their relationship. And that felt incredibly disappointing, considering how central their brother, their brotherhood was to this entire story. But I would have I felt that we also should have seen a resolution with the Parliament of the Green now that they have been rebuilt and the entire Green has been restored. There should have been some kind of punitive action at Prescott Industries, as well as detailing the company's future now that Mr. Pilgrim and the Pale Wanderer is trapped in the tree and is no longer running the company. So some kind of resolution there that addresses everything that's happening both presently and in the future with Prescott Industries. And we never got any resolution with Jack Hawksmoore when you think about it. I mean, he just sort of showed up, had some scenes with Swamp Thing, and then just kind of disappeared from the story. And we never got that final, you know, cathartic moment between the two, you know, establishing their relationship. One thing that I also felt was disappointing was we didn't have that final reaffirmation of Levi and Jennifer's relationship, especially after everything that has occurred. We have a small scene of that towards the end where they're in the forest of Kaziranga and they're, you know, talking about how Levi feels like everything's changed. And certainly he's probably talking about their relationship too, though it's not explicitly stated. But I feel like just a final affirmation of their love and their appreciation of each other would have been really appreciated and would have gone a long way. You don't want to rip off, you know, Alan Moore too much or Scott Snyder, because I know they both did that in their respective endings of Swamp Thing, where, you know, Alec affirms his love for Abby and then does the same at the end of Scott Snyder's run. But I felt like it was needed, again, considering how important their relationship was to this story. The Clash of Ideas callback was a nice way to bring things full circle, but it just felt like there was so much left unresolved that it was ultimately just a really unfortunate way to end the series. So I think that this would have benefited from some kind of double-sized or, again, an additional issue that could have served as a coda that would have addressed all of these unresolved emotional and story threads that would have just put a final decisive cap on the series. So for as much as I loved the series so far, I would be lying to myself if I said this was a great ending, because it really isn't. And it felt like it could have been and should have been so much more. So I had to give it a 7.5 out of 10. I must admit, I'm kind of disappointed.
Did you say a 7.5 out of 10?
I did, yeah. So it's an average score, you know, it's not bad.
Yeah, it's an average score. But
it should have been, you know, that whoa, like that really just bombastic end. And that doesn't mean fighting and chaos and everything. It just, all the emotional beats should have just hit and hit and hit. So you walk away and you say, that was conclusive. And I just didn't feel like that, especially given everything that's happened in the story.
See, I feel like the way that he was able to make us as readers give a shit about all the little tiny details that we didn't get at the very end of this, I think that says a lot about his ability as a writer. I also think that I'm not saying that Ron V would have done it, but it also seems that this was written for another 4 issues. Mm-hmm. Like maybe this finale would have been stretched out until the next issue, and then we would have started to see, we would have saw the resolution of what's going, or at least the next step forward with what's going on with the parliaments, and as such, Jack Hawksmoore, potentially an issue that does delve with, you know, their relationship between him and Jennifer. I mean, there are all kinds of one-shot issues that I could rattle off the top of my head I would love to see with Levi in it. And what it really boils down to is I want another 8-issue run.
although again, I feel like if you wanted to have a decisive ending, it would have been better to just really close the book on all of these relationships and have that, you know, satisfying ending.
I'm not going to argue with that. Do you think that that is a Ron V decision, or do you think that is a publishing decision?
To be honest, I don't know, actually. And that's why I thought about it for a little bit, because when I finished it on Monday, because I'm special, I get my comics on Monday. I remember thinking, I was like, I know that this isn't like a, you know, I remember we were pretty savage on the end of James Tynan's Fear State. And I think that was because the Substack news had come out and it really just looked like he knew he was exiting the book. So he's like, let me just fucking put whatever out, and but I'm out though. Like it's you already have one foot out the door, so you don't really have to care about it. So you can have a very lazy ending. But I don't get the feeling that this is that. This is very much like a
No.
maybe he just didn't have enough time and space to do that. And I understand that. There's only so much you can do. But again, that's why
Yeah.
I think maybe if, you know, if and I'm glad that they were able to extend the series, but I feel like as it got closer to 16, and maybe they knew that there was more that needed to be done to conclude the story, and they just didn't feel like they wanted to do that. DC was ultimately like, wrap it up, and I don't care how you do it, even if it's not quite as conclusive as it should be. So I don't think it's a Rom V thing. I don't think he's, you know, like he got lazy or was like, well, it's already over, so let me just wrap it up, however, and I'm out the door because I'm already writing Batman. I think it was probably just, you know, he didn't have enough space, and there's only so much you can do in, you know, 20 to 22 pages. So,
Right.
you know, it's sort of out of his control. I can't really blame him for that too much, but at least for how I feel, I just, you know, wish I'd had more. And whether that's on DC or if it really is on Romvi, I don't know. But you know, that's just how I was feeling.
Gotcha. I love this. I loved it start to finish. I do think that there were more things that I wanted to find out about. More things that I wanted to go deeper than a sentence or two worth of mentioning at the end of this. But I think, again, that that is all because of how engrossed I became in the Swamp Thing due to this creative team. And I don't want to hold too much of that against it, with it just being those little things that, like, honestly, who gives a shit what happened to Jack Hawksmoore except I do. You know what I mean?
Well, I do,
Most.
just because it felt like he was serving an important role in the story.
And
Like
then
he and Levi
disappeared.
had multiple, yeah, and then disappeared. And it's sort of like that's why I was like, I was sort of scratching my head, like, what? Why
No,
were you
because
here
he.
then? What was the point?
Because he can talk to cities. I mean, I, there. Right.
You could have
There
just come up
are.
with a new character of no significance to do. I don't know. It just stuff
Or
like that
Danny
felt
the
weird.
Street.
But yeah, but ultimately, again, the ones that were most important to me were, you know, Levi and Jacob, because they were so central to
Yes,
the story, and
that
Levi and
one
Jennifer.
was
And the fact that,
disappointing.
yeah, the fact that, especially Jacob, who, like, he doesn't even appear in this issue at all. He's, you know, mentioned in the very end, but it's like in respect to a story that they've already told. It's not like, you know,
Moving
Levi.
forward from that.
Yeah, it's not like Levi is mentioned as having had a conversation with Jacob after, you know, his stuff with the Parliament of Green. It's like they're reiterating a story they already told, and that to me, I think, was just the most disappointing one.
Fair enough. Well, I mean, like I said, I loved it. I thought this was great. It is now officially my new favorite Swamp Thing run. No offense to Alan Moore, of course, the saga is always going to be a classic piece of Swamp Thing literature, comic history, but it is now officially number two on my list. This was perfect from start to almost finish, and the finish wasn't weak enough for me to, for me to really, really hold any problems against it. So I gave this one a 9.25 out of 10.
Yeah, I think for me at least, this is going to be kind of an example of so much energy and so much love into a story that ultimately comes to a very weak ending, which is going to be kind of disappointing looking back. I mean, I feel like it did close the book on just Levi, but in terms of how Levi was connected to everything else, it feels like it really dropped the ball. And that's that. I think that's going to kind of, no pun intended, haunt me for a little bit. But yeah, I just again, I maybe there's something further down the line that will really close the book on this, but as for now, I just feel like it was deeply unsatisfying. But maybe the next one won't be, and we'll shift our attention over to that, which is Task Force X number 11, a penultimate chapter in our 12 issue saga, and I'm gonna hand that over to Josh to give us the summary.
All right, that's Task Force Z.
Task Force Z, but I don't know why I had that as Task Force X.
Because that's Suicide Squad. Makes sense.
Yeah.
Number 11, script by Matthew Rosenberg, art team Inside and Out by Eddie Barrows, Eber Friera, and Adriana Lucas, with Rob Lee on letters. It starts out with Jason and Dent when this all started, how Jason was forced to do this to go to prison, or he was going to go to prison. Then it moves to Jason leaving Dent after finding out that Bane was fake. Two-Face saying he doesn't know who it is. He goes back the next day to show Dent a newspaper that shows fake Bane has been out there messing shit up. Then Gotham Girl busts into Bloom's hideout. She breaks a lot of his stuff in the process, and she is there for her zombie brother Gotham, who still has Bane's memories. Red Hood busts up on the scene too. They're in a different part, and he has to fight against his old team, Deadshot, Arkham Knight, Man Bat. He takes down two. Gotham shows up. He gets shot and knocked to the ground. Pretty bad wound in his chest. Then he gets clobbered all to hell by Gotham Girl. Task Force Z.2 shows up, and Bloom makes pretty quick work of them, fighting them in some kind of souped-up robot bat suit. Things are looking pretty bad at this point, but don't worry, it does get worse. Jason and Dent are both strapped to surgical tables while Bloom looks on next to a zombie wearing Red Hood's costume. Jason bluffs about a tracker, tricking Fake Hood into pushing a self-destruction button that blows up the whole building. Whoa. So, aside from one nag for me, the fact that Bloom says that they are there because he wants to steal their memories, then on the next page, Fake Hood is talking like he already has them. But the dialogue wouldn't track if that were the case. That part kind of irked me just a little bit. Barros, Ferreira, and Lucas absolutely kill it in every book. Rosenberg has made a seriously awesome zombie story come to life. I enjoyed this issue quite a bit. One more thing is, so strapped to a table, Fake Hood presses the button. There's no way that Jason Todd survives that. And this ties in with the rest of the universe at large. So does that mean Jason will forever be dead, dependent on Lazarus resin?
I mean, I think you know the answer to that, but... I mean,
he's got a habit of coming back to life. But regardless, yeah, exactly. my score is going to be 8 out of 10. Did you give this one a read?
I did. I didn't know if you finished giving your score. You kind of cut out for a second there.
Oh, yeah. I gave it an 8 out of 10.
Okay. No, I gave this one a 7.5 out of 10 as well. This was a solid chapter, but I think, I don't know. I remember last month I was there was something about the humor in that issue that was really working for me, and I think this one was kind of like the opposite, where there were moments that definitely had me, you know, chuckling here and there, but it felt a little too chatty at points. And it, I think, kind of, and maybe this is just because we're in chapter 11 and we're like literally one issue before the end, but it did feel a little kind of chaotic because you have all these plot threads that are coming together, but we're jumping around constantly. So you're going from, you know, Jason fighting the second iteration of Task Force Z, but there's also the flashbacks where we're getting more information about Dent and his knowledge of, you know, the fake Bane and how he knew this whole time. And we're also cutting back to, you know, Harvey leading his team under the tunnels to try and intercept Bloom and everything. So it's just a lot going on. And they all kind of converge at the end, which was good. But for the majority of the issue, it was a little messy for me. So I think once it finally got to the end and like the last 5 or 6 pages where it's just Bloom kind of detailing his stuff and... you know, we finally get the explosion at the end. I think that was where I was like, oh, okay, yeah, now I'm really into it, and I'm interested to see what happens next. But I feel like a lot of stuff in this issue was just a little messier. But I think that's kind of par for the course with a penultimate issue. Sometimes you can have one that's really good, and sometimes you can have one that's just kind of all over the place. I did think it was very funny seeing Bloom running around in the Jim Gordon super heavy suit. There's something weirdly poetic about that, considering he was fighting that suit, you know, not even a couple of years ago. And
I didn't even realize that was Bat Bunny.
yeah, no, it had the arm cannons and everything, or the shoulder
I
cannons, I
didn't
should
even
say.
realize it, man. Didn't even put that together. Damn.
Crazy. Good to see Gotham Girl and Gotham have their brief reunion, even if it was a little warped. So there's some good stuff here. Again, just a little messy in terms of story. So 7.5 out of 10 for me.
I'll give you that. Definitely a little messy for sure. But it's zombies. You almost got to expect
I guess so, yeah. Although
it.
that's a little more messy in like the gross sense, not in the story sense.
Fair enough.
But
Fair enough.
we're gonna cut over to another book that's ending. I don't know what it is with books that are ending or almost ending this week, but it seems like we have a few of them. And that's Robin number 17, our final issue, at least until we get into Robin versus Batman or Batman versus Robin or whatever it's called in about a month from now. But yes, that is Robin number 17, brought to us by Joshua Williamson with Roger Cruz, inks from Norm Ratmond, colors from Luis Guerrero, and letters from Troy Pateri. This one is going to seem shockingly short, but trust me, it's not my fault. Hawk, Robin, and Flatline returning to Lazarus Island to fight a monstrified version of Lord Deathman, who was transformed into this creature by Mother Soul after she betrayed Lord Deathman. They beat LDM, no surprise, and Damien kills him in a moment that calls back to the first issue, allowing him to revert to his original self. And now they want to do something fun now that the worst is over. So everyone on Lazarus Island has a montage of fun beach moments. Then, following that, everyone leaves the island, following Hawk and Flatline to go on their own missions, and the issue ends. Did I miss anything?
Nope.
Exactly. Again, that seems shockingly short, but that was literally the entire issue. Like, I wish there was more. Mother Soul disappeared, but that's kind of implied from the fact that she betrayed Lord Deathman.
Right. And at
Wow,
the end,
yeah.
Robin, we're shown Robin, or Damien rather, touching that fucking nasal wall again.
Which we saw in was that World's Finest number 5?
World's
I believe
finest.
so.
Yeah.
I mean it's funny. We've been talking about this for months. I remember Rob and I were going back, especially saying, I'm afraid that because this book is ending at 17, it's gonna just kind of rush to its end because it just doesn't have enough time and it's not really gonna have a satisfying conclusion. And that's sort of exactly how I feel. I mean, emotionally, I feel like it did everything that it needed to do for Damien, which is nice and that's good. It gave Damien an arc. It felt conclusive, and even though everyone is kind of leaving him, it felt like he really did mature and grow in a way. Though, based on the solicits and information we have for Batman and Robin, they're probably just gonna throw all that out the window. That being said, for this series at least, it feels like Damien did have a conclusive arc. But the story, oh my God, yeah, talk about a rushed ending. Like, it's literally just they fight Lord Deathman, the end. Do not resolve anything with Mother Soul. I know that's going to be a part of Batman versus Robin, but it just feels weird that like all that stuff just exited the
Nothing
book and then
happened.
it's over. It's a tough one because as a character story, it certainly worked for Damien, but as a story, like the actual plot of the story, it just feels like a very weak and disappointing ending. So I had to give this one a 7.25 out of 10. The art team is solid as usual, but it's just kind of sad that, and I think it's just the fact that this book had to end early for Batman versus Robin, and also the fact that they need Tim Drake to be Robin again, that sort of killed this book while it was really running high. But the fact that it had kind of a weak ending due to that, interference is sad. And it's unfortunate the book had to go out like this, but it is what it is. And I can't pretend like I loved it, even though I loved pretty much every other part of this book. As far as endings go, this was not great.
Yeah, I'm with you there. It was a pretty damn good series right up until the tournament. After that, there were some really good issues, some good issues
Oh, you
that
mean the
made
end of the
dip.
tournament or?
Yeah, the end of the
Yeah,
tournament.
okay.
And there would be some really good issues, some decent ones. There'd be a dip and then go back up. But this one just fucking nosedived, man. I care I care about Damien finding the nasal wall thing. That's important, but nothing else that happened in this book meant anything at all. It literally, this book didn't even need to be made. There was nothing that happened.
Well, it was a good emotional arc for Damien, which I think is important, especially after everything that had happened after Alfred's death and with the Titans. And I think all that stuff needed to happen, just getting Damien back to a good place in his life. So that's why I say the emotional stuff was important.
And I'm not arguing with you there, but to drag it out and give me 3 pages of Damien and Flatlight hanging out on a beach, we already had that a few issues ago, and I don't need that anymore. You can imply that Damien is doing better, and I'll get it because of all the shit that I've been reading for the last 17 issues, plus everything that came before you. Four pages of beach blanket bingo isn't contributing to writing a comic book. Not an interesting one anyway. Not for me. Now, did you happen to, was that Respawn in the fucking shadows?
It was, yeah. And I didn't know if that was a ghost or if Respawn is somehow alive. I wouldn't be surprised to see him maybe show up in Batman versus Robin or whatever future stuff they have planned for Damien. But yes, that was Respawn.
Alright, I thought so. Alright, well, even with all that, I'm gonna give Robin a 6.75 out of 10, because even though it's Williamson, I expected a better ending than this. And maybe that was my fault, but this one just turned bad at the end, man. Just turned bad.
Yeah. 6.75. Well, again, like with Swamp Thing, I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt and say that it was because they just didn't have enough time to kind of all wrap it up in an effective way. I really hope that is the case. I was thinking about this, and it does feel like the larger story at least kind of ended after the Lazarus tournament. And I mean... I know people probably would have been upset with this, but I really think maybe they should have just had this be a 12-issue series. And then for the tie-ins with Shadow War, those could have just been Shadow War-specific Robin tie-ins. Yeah, and then for the final 3 issues, you could have just called it, because this is essentially what it was, but you really should have just called it, you know, Road to Batman versus Robin, or Batman versus Robin Road to War, or Robin : Prelude to Batman versus Robin, or something that indicates that this is setting up, you know, that miniseries, because that's essentially what issues 15, 16, and 17 were. Maybe with the exception of 15, because that was sort of like a coda to Shadow War. But I don't know. I feel like it really would have just benefited if they had maybe just ended the book after 12 and then everything else was told in another fashion, so that this version of Robin, this series of Robin, could have had a really conclusive end instead of just, you know, going off until it died a sad death.
Right. Speaking of death, I guess that's a good segue to move on to the next book, huh?
Sure. Yeah, let's do it.
Deathstroke Inc. number 12, written by Ed Brisson, art from Dexter Soy, colors from Veronica Gandini, letters Steve Wands, wrapped in a cover from Mikkel Janin. This is year one of Deathstroke, chapter 3. So in the last issue, Slade went after the man who tried to kill him, but he got interrupted by Green Arrow. That's still going on. After a good-looking fight spread over a few pages, Slade gets the upper hand and tosses Ollie off of the roof before going back about his business, though he is far from the merciless Deathstroke that we all know and love today. He hesitates, and it gives Green Arrow time to tackle him again. Green Arrow just shows up out of nowhere. This time, Ollie whoops on Deathstroke and even gets his mask off. After Wintergreen and Arrow save him from being executed by government agents, Arrow calls in the authorities for him to be arrested. That's when Ollie asks him who he is, and he tells him Deathstroke, which is the first time that he's used that name. Then Slade runs, dives off the building. Ollie shoots him with a roped arrow to keep him, you know, captured. Slade thinks to himself that he would rather die than go to prison, so he cuts the rope and crashes to the ground below in front of all the people that were gathered there watching the fight from the city below, including Wintergreen. Wintergreen happened to be on the phone with Mrs. Wilson, and that's because she's looking for Slade throughout the issue, and that's because she is pregnant. I don't think anybody has a need for a Deathstroke origin story, but yeah. Brisson is giving me one that I just want to read it. And I never ever would have said if I get to pick anybody for an origin story, Deathstroke sure as shit would not have been in the top 5 or 10. And this is a good read so far. If it keeps up this trend, man, when it comes out as a trade, because you know it will, our readers are going to blow right through this whole thing. Dexter Soy is an art wonderkind, and Gandini's colors work so well with his that, I mean, I just really like this issue, and I gave it an 8.5.
No, that's awesome. No, this one got an 8 out of 10 for me. Just really solid read. Super cool to see, you know, the classic version of Ollie with the kind of Robin Hood costume and everything. I still was kind of hoping for, you know, some kind of scene where Ollie's like, you know, I'm working for the feds, but I don't really want to be here either, man. You know, in classic protester Ollie fashion. But we didn't get that. So that's obviously why the book's getting an 8 out of 10. But yeah, other than that, it was just solid stuff. I think Brisson has a great voice for Deathstroke, and you know, I'm looking forward to seeing how this the story continues.
Mm-hmm. You and me both, my friend.
All right. Well, that wraps it up for our spotlight section, so we're going to turn it off until we flash it on again next time. But before we get into our main books, we're going to take a brief break, so stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Now, back to our program.
All right, we are going to jump back in with the rest of the reviews for this week, starting off with Detective Comics number 1063. This is the continuation of our four-part opening arc from Rom V and Raphael Albuquerque called Gotham Nocturne. But there are some other people that are very much important to this story's construction as well. Colors from Dave Stewart and letters from Ariana Marr. If you felt that my summary for Robin was a little bit on the shorter side, trust me, this is going to more than make up for it because, wow, there's a lot going on in this chapter. So, where to begin? At the Bavaria in the seedy part of Gotham City is a man with two faces. Once a feared villain of Gotham City, an enemy of the dread Dark Knight, he is simply Harvey Dent these days, a humble citizen of Gotham City. Changes in the air for all, it seems, as Bruce Wayne meets with this new Harvey Dent to discuss and explore some of the changes he feels in the city. This is mostly related to the silence of the criminal underworld, which the Dark Knight detective finds stubborn and obstinate. With a vacuum of power present in Gotham's underworld, something fearful is attempting to insert itself in the empty space, something ancient and fearful. Harvey questions whether this is truly the case or simply Gotham's changes outpacing Bruce, something Bruce refuses to accept. We cut to the mysterious Arzen, member of the Orgum family, being given a history lesson of the Orgum connection to Gotham City, how it was fundamental in the foundation of the early Gotham colony in the 17th century, and its roots in the name Arkham, specifically during the 19th and 20th century. We learn of why this family has chosen now, of all moments, to take back control of Gotham, and it's in response to the destruction of Arkham we saw a few months ago. But while Arkham may be a rotting husk, Blackgate is far from that, as Batman makes his way into the prison easily, seeking an audience with a man known as the Maestro. He believes that if anyone can understand the mystery of the music box, it would be him. Maestro examines the work and the music and tells Batman of the musical theory of black noise, music that contained harmonics well below audible frequencies, but music that could influence and change a person. This unnerves Batman, who is haunted by visions of the Bat Demon, as we saw in the last issue. The Bat Demon, who may have always been within Bruce from the very beginning, even before his parents were murdered. The implications of this go unexplained, at least for now, as we cut back to Harvey Dent, who has another encounter with Gael Tenclaw of the Orgums after leaving the club. Disappointed with the state of Harvey's present form, Gael tells him of the Asmer, ancient beings of power that adhere to their master's call, and informs him that his time to serve them is at hand, and he will serve them as an Asmer. But there is another voice who is manifested to protect Harvey from this intrusive being. Now that this evil creature has tethered itself to Harvey's soul, one Harvey thought was locked away, but was always there, hiding in the shadows of his mind. So yeah, if that description wasn't haunting and terrifying and chilling and ominous and dramatic and all the words for you, I don't know what is, because this was just, again, as a follow-up to last month's issue, just a wonderful way to continue this wonderful operatic story. And still has me very much intrigued in what's going to happen next with, I mean, a lot of different things with the Orgum family, with, you know, Bruce's whole psychological profile, with the idea of Black Noise and this mysterious music box. I mean, there's definitely a lot of plot threads going on here, but all of them, I think, are interesting enough that it's like, you know, I almost want to just pick and choose which one I want to see, but I'm not sure because every one is appealing as the next. So it's definitely one that is keeping me on my toes right now, and it feels good to finally be back reading Detective Comics and excited for what's coming in next month's issue. I mean, I know we, you know, had some moments in Mariko Tamaki's run that were definitely very exciting, especially during the first two arcs or so, I'd say. But this, I feel like, is definitely return to form after everything that was happening with the tower, where I'm really just, I'm happy and excited to be reading Detective and just, you know, curious as to what's going to happen next. So this one got a very strong 8.5 out of 10 for me.
Hell yeah, it did. Hell yeah, it did. I couldn't agree with your sentiment more about how much better this is than recent Detective story arcs. Going through the issue, man, there's a lot of stuff that I like about this. Starting with the way that the song lyrics were lettered at the very beginning in the club. That was cool. A gold half-mast Harvey Dent with a new coin, cured of Two-Face. That's awesome. A really cool idea. It looked great, but the poor guy can't catch a break, though, huh? Like, ever?
I know, seriously. And it has me wondering how Task Force X is going to wrap up now that we've seen this new seemingly cured version of Harvey Dent, you know, that we hadn't seen before. So I just want to know, like, you know, Task Force 12, is Harvey going to have his whole profile fixed and that's how he became this mysterious man with the gold mask and everything? Hope so.
We'll find out. Or maybe we won't. Who knows? The book is definitely taking a grounded Batman is hella human approach, explaining, like, breaking down why he's able to break into Blackgate Prison. I really enjoy that part of this writing. This was a really well-written, very interesting detective story starring Batman right up until the time that Batman started to feel the effects of the music. And then that's when we add in, like, horror to it, too. It just has this dark feeling with Barbados, or Barbados, however we're going to say it.
I think it's Barbatos or I'm trying to think because it's, when you see it in the lettering, it's split between, like, I think the word is ellipses or something. It has, like, those dots in between each like chunk of the word. So it's bar ba tos. And so in my mind, I'm imagining them saying it, like, kind of slowly, like bar ba tos or something like that, which definitely feels more. We talked last month about, you know, a possible connection to the death metal stuff. And I don't think it's that at all. I think it's, if anything, it's more related to some of the stuff that Pete Milligan and Grant Morrison were doing when that idea was originally introduced by Milligan and was later picked up by Morrison. So it's more demonic in nature rather than cosmic, which is definitely interesting.
Well, let's stick with that because that's a fantastic idea. I don't know where. Okay, so the Barbados thing, if it's done right, and I'm down to explore this more, but it is a very hard line to walk. It could get real dark, real spooky, real scary, or even mystical. It could go into a whole lot of eternal dialogue. I have no idea what this book is going to look like, and that excites me. So much potential. And that's because this has just set up so much of a story. It's going to be a difficult story to pull off satisfactorily. But Ram V is one of the few creators that I have faith in that could possibly pull this off. And as far as the backup goes, it is the best one that I have read in a long time. Tales of Metropolis, Justice League Dark, which was written by Ram V. And this one, top three in the last few years, hands down. The whole issue... it gets a hell yeah, man. I give it a 9.25 out of 10.
Very nice, very nice. Well, we're not quite done with this issue, as we have a backup to discuss, and that is one featuring Jim Gordon, a three-parter, written by Cy Spurrier with art from Danny, colors from Dave Stewart, and letters from Aditya Bidikar. This one is going to be a much shorter summary, because that last one was painfully long. Well, I mean, not painfully for me, but I understand it was very lengthy, but it kind of had to be. But Jim Gordon continues his investigation into Anne Redding's missing boy as he bounced from one location to the next. Realizing that he might have just been played by the cops or by Miss Redding all along, he resigns himself to simply watching Redding, only to find out that there is a deeper mystery at play here, one that could have explosive results. Solid chapter. I don't know that I loved it quite as much as I loved the last one. That one was just something really special. But this one definitely kept it going and certainly had my interest. I don't know. I'm kind of just like, this feels like a, because it's a three-parter, it definitely feels like a middle-of-the-road chapter where it's good, but you kind of want to see how it all wraps up before you make any conclusive, statements about how much you enjoyed it, or at least for me. So this one got an 8 out of 10 for me. Solid stuff. I'm going to give the entire issue an 8.5 just because I love the main story so much. But the backup, solid stuff. So can't complain there.
No, can't complain there. And I've disliked on the regular just about every backup that's been around. So if I'm saying that I like it, I mean, it great. I might, if the third issue bombs, oh well, but at least it got me to enjoy the two of them. Tales of Metropolis and Justice League Dark were the other two, and that's in the last few years. But yeah, the backup's awesome. The front is fantastic. Like I said, man, 9 out of 10. It's absolutely great.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree. We've got another big one following that. Something that I think many of us were anticipating following the end of the explosive and quite epic trial of the Amazons, and that is our Hippolyta Olympus tie-in, or I think it's called Olympus Rebirth officially. Yes. So I'm going to pass that one over to Josh.
All right. Yes, it is Olympus Rebirth number one. Script from Michael W. Conrad and Becky Cloonan, Caitlin Yarsky on art, Jordi Belair on colors. Letters from Pat Brazo, and a great cover from Julian Totino Tedesco. It's worth noting that this does happen right after the end of the Trial of the Amazons. Philippus, Faruka, and Queen Nubia are talking, gathered round a new statue of Hippolyta being erected away from the main city so that it's a quiet place to gather. Meanwhile, Hippolyta is doing something quite different. Her travels through the afterlife. After crossing the River Styx, she is greeted by... excuse me. She is greeted by Demeter, Athena, and Hestia, and Artemis. And they are friendly faces for her. But it is far from the end of her journey. After making it to Olympus, she finds most of the gods like Zeus and Poseidon are just sitting there, drunk off their asses, happy that she's there. She noticed that Hera isn't present, though, and that's because Hera isn't happy that she's there, saying that she'll become one of the most powerful should she attain godhood, and apparently Hera has some Napoleonic complexes. she's not wrong. Lady Justice informs Hippolyta, that her existence is powered by, that their existence, excuse me, is powered by belief, and a vast majority of that comes from the Amazons. So should she become a god, it could threaten the existence of most of the rest of them, as the Amazons would likely focus their worship on Hippolyta. Hippolyta and Aphrodite then take a trip to the graveyard of the gods to finish what they keep saying Wonder Woman started. And, I mean, I guess that's Conrad and Clunan's trip through with Wonder Woman's The Afterlife, and it doesn't really line up here at all. But in any case, they go to the graveyard of the gods, and they find that Aniope and Atalanta are in the graveyard, but their rescue goes easy, pretty easy, kind of. They're rescued, but then decide to stay dead. Hippolyta finds Chaos there as well, chained up, and she releases him to go back to the Pantheon. Now proven as a god, she returns as well. Hera, not happy, and who Chaos immediately teams up with, attacks Hippolyta. They fight, but Hera can't keep Diana's name out of her mouth, and that makes Hippolyta lose it, so she kills Hera, which is like, whoa, I did not see this shit coming so fast. Next, mm-hmm. we see her racing through the Elysian fields, except that didn't happen. It was Hecate messing with her the whole time, trying to find out if Hippolyta was truly worthy of being a god. This is probably the one of the best damn things Clunan and Conrad have written in a hot minute. I haven't been a fan of much, if any, at all lately. With the exception of the Batgirls, some of those are pretty good. This mm-hmm. though, this was pretty damn cool. A little all over, a little weird, but there is a really good foundation laid here. I hope that they don't mess it up. Oh, and this Caitlin Yarsky, that name doesn't sound familiar, but wow,
it wouldn't. But yes, no, Caitlin Yarsky is a name that. That I only learned of quite recently because she did Black Hammer Reborn. With Jeff Lemire over on Dark Horse. Right. But she had done some books with a writer I'm not too familiar with, Sean Lewis, called Coyote, and basically had pretty much maintained a pretty exclusive working relationship with him. So to my knowledge, this is her first kind of big DC debut, which I was very excited about because I thought she absolutely killed it over on Black Hammer Reborn, even if the story wasn't up to snuff. I think she'll be a name that you'll definitely be seeing more of in the future. Although I'm hoping that she can definitely also keep up with her creator-owned and independent stuff as well. I'd hate to lose her there.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, as an artist, man, she's fantastic. And I'm just going to say it. I would really love to see a book, any book, even a one-shot, by Caitlin Yarsky and Chip Zdarsky. Zdarsky and Yarsky, creators at large. I'm going to need that.
Is that just because their names sound alike?
That's just because their names sound so close.
Yeah, I thought as much.
But anyway, man, this was an easy 8.75. And I think that they would actually, they probably wouldn't do too bad together. I like this Yarsky's art style. But yeah, 8.75 out of 10.
Nice. No, I have only seen her work with two other people, that being Jeff Lemire and Sean Lewis. So I have no idea. I can't really say whether or not they would work well together, but I'm sure it could be interesting. This one got an 8 out of 10 for me. I didn't have a ton to say. I thought it was very solid. Definitely a compelling read for Hippolyta. And I do like this version. I don't know if it's the newest or latest version because we've kind of been reading Wonder Woman very sporadically. So I don't remember what the exact newest incarnation of the Olympian gods was, but to my knowledge, I think this is a new one.
It is. At least they even address that in the books. I remember.
Yeah. They
have changed their appearance to reflect how they feel since being rescued from the graveyard of the gods.
Yes. And we've seen that before. The one that always comes to mind is, you know, Greg Rucka's run, which had the most 2000s inspired designs for the Olympian gods that you will ever see. Right down to like, yeah, right down to like the baggy pants and oh my God. But no, I like this iteration of the Olympian gods, and I think it's a solid story for Hippolyta. Nothing groundbreaking, just kind of okay. You know, Hippolyta is far from one of my favorite characters. As a read, it's not bad. You could do a lot worse. So 8 out of 10 for me.
Right on, right on, right on. Well,
all right. Well, yeah. If all that is said and done, we will get into our last book for this week. Man, where did the time go? And that is Action Comics number 1046. But will it bring the action? I sure hope so. With this creative team, brought to us by Philip Kennedy Johnson, this time with art from Fico Osio, colors from Lee Lowridge, and letters from Dave Sharp. After dealing with the Leviathan that guards the door to the Fire of Olgrun, Superman must face off against Olgrun himself, or his spirit anyway. He does so, managing not to harm Olgrun's spirit too much, or the girl that he realizes is controlling it, and even attempts to save her at one point. The girl, realizing Superman's immense kindness, bequeaths the Fire of Olgrun to Superman, encouraging him not to lose it or to lose his mind to it. Superman then returns to Krilux and the kids, feeling re-empowered and hopeful of his return to Earth soon, only to find that Krilux has betrayed the kids and Superman to Mongol. Now, Mongol, with the kids at his mercy, demands that Superman give him the Fire of Olgrun, or the children shall die. And this will be continued in the monumental War World Apocalypse, I think, next week. So you don't have to wait that long, which is great, I think. I mean, it's I gave this one an 8.25 out of 10, which may sound kind of low, but it's really not. It's like this is just yet another solid chapter in the War World Revolution arc, but you know, also a solid chapter in the War World saga as a whole, and as a penultimate issue, I think it does a you know, decent job of getting everything in place and getting you hyped and excited for the big showdown throwdown between Superman and Mongol. So it'll be interesting to see how all that plays out. The art from Fico Osio is decent, though I think probably would have been better with a different colorist, but you know, other than that, it's a solid read, and definitely has me hyped for how Mongol and Superman are really gonna throw down in an epic fight in the next issue. So we'll see how it all plays out. How did you feel?
We sure will, man. First, dude, I mean, amazing art. Not our normal artist here, but Fico Osio is just still top tier talent, and the visuals that you get in this particular book with the bright lights and whatnot they're just gorgeous, man. The colors, artists know what they're doing. There's a few panels where I don't like Clark's face, but other than that, it's pretty much just great. Now, what a action-packed issue. The whole thing, non-stop action. We transition from to the next arc of this epic at the end of this issue, and it does so with a cliffhanger. At the same time, very little actually happens in this issue, though the things that do are important. I feel like the cliffhanger we got was a bit way too obvious. But it's a solid chapter. It is a solid installment of this story. Every single one of them has been. The tiniest of problems, a couple overall, which is, you know, barely worth mentioning if it wasn't what I got on here to do. So I also gave this one an 8.25 out of 10.
Nice. Well, like with Detective Comics, we're not quite done with this story, as we have one more backup to chat about before we head to our top three. That one is also written by Philip Kennedy Johnson, with art by David Latham, colors from Trish Mulvihill, and letters from Dave Sharp. This is part 4 or part 5, I'm not sure, of World Without Clark Kent, featuring the rest of the Super Fam, and of course Lois Lane, because she's an honorary member, even if she's a Kryptonian, although she's not really in this issue. But back on Earth, the Super Family pursue Conduit, a.k.a. Kenny Braverman, and have no problem subduing him. It looks like all is lost for Mr. Braverman, but in a last-ditch attempt to win, he grabs the Genesis Fragment and harnesses its power, which is killing him. Steel smashes the fragment to save his life, an action which is now damned Thou Law. Steel isn't worried, however, as is what Superman would have done, and he knows that they'll find a way to save Thou Law even without the fragment. Solid stuff. I mean, I don't know. This is another one that, like, I feel like I didn't have a lot to say. It was sort of just, you know, it's continuing the World Without Clark Kent story, and it's great to see all the Super Family interacting. And there's a part of me that, because it says continued in Superman War World Apocalypse, and there's a part of me that's wondering if they're going to find some kind of way to bring the rest of the Super Family to War World so they can all join Clark in the fight against Mongol, which would be awesome because it's been way too long since we've seen them all together, you know, fighting as one giant family. I think they did some stuff in the Bendis run, but I didn't read it. So I don't know.
They did. They were all together in the actions run. But the problem with that was JRJR was drawing it, so you couldn't tell who was who. And I'm not just being facetious. Like, the only one you could identify at any given time was Kara.
Well, I did not read it, so I don't know. Although I'm imagining you're exaggerating just a little bit, but I'm sure that's because we have different artistic tastes. But I dropped off of action at that point. I was like, there's no way I'm reading this schlock. But this is much better. If you want to read your Super Family stuff and not feel like crap, I would say read this because it's a solid read. And I'm very hopeful, fingers crossed, that the Super Family will be showing up to give Clark a hand. Not that he needs it, but I'm sure he'll appreciate it over on War World in the War World Apocalypse one-shot coming out next week. Let me just double check that so I'm not like talking out of my ass. Let's see. Yes, that is next week, August 30th. Ooh, so all right, you don't have to wait too long. Yep, you got it right good there. News. But yeah. Yeah, so good stuff. I gave this one an 8 out of 10. Whole issue, I'll still give it an 8.25 out of 10. But still good stuff.
Some of the profile shots of the art I wasn't a big fan of, but overall, this whole backup idea is pretty cool. Still don't know how I feel about Kara's hairstyle, but I'll get over that.
I think it's very classic looking. It's,
yeah,
it's
very 60s. Classic. Very classic. Yeah. But I like it. It's a good story. I can't wait to read the conclusion for it. The whole thing gets an 8.25 out of 10 from me.
Excellent stuff. Excellent stuff. All right. Well, if we are all set and done with our main reviews this week, my God, that sure went by fast. But we were just rolling today. We were just just all about business. I think it's because Rob isn't here. Because even though he may be quiet, he always keeps us going. He's like the unseen hand that keeps the conversation going and going and going. And without him, we are sorely, sorely lacking. But like I said, I hope we're doing our best to entertain you. But before we close out, we're going to head over to our top three books for this week, which I'm going to pass over to Josh so he can give us his top three and his favorite moment, which I know he has one.
I definitely do. My top three are all huge books. Number three, I'm going to give to Olympus Rebirth. I really enjoyed that, even though it did come from Conrad and Clunan. And I hope
sometimes even the worst can surprise you.
I'm saying, man, it came out. This came out really, really good. And I'm not by any stretch calling them the worst. I've just shit on them a lot lately over the course of the last year.
But they're not terrible or anything. I've just made fun of them and called them terrible writers multiple times.
Well, mostly Conrad. But in any case, Olympus Rebirth is definitely worth to read. Detective Comics, or excuse me, damn it, Swamp Thing number 16, I am giving to second place to. A phenomenal run, a phenomenal book, phenomenal art, phenomenal story. It's just flat out amazing. But that guy's other piece of work that he put out this week, I had to give it to that one. I'm giving number one to Detective Comics number 1063, Ron V's other entry this week that was just beyond wonderful, and I absolutely loved it. I can't figure out what kind of book this is going to be, but I know it's going to be a hell of a ride. So looking forward to that. My favorite moment was in Action Comics in the double page splash right after the whole Truth and Justice bit. In one of those panels, you can see Clark surfing on a circuit board. I had, did you catch that one?
I did see that. And it was, did you, well, you probably didn't, but did your kids ever watch the show Cyber Chase?
I don't think so. Maybe.
Okay. Yeah. It's a show that anyone who was born after like 1999 has definitely seen at one point or another. But it's a show that's like three kids are, you know, in the internet, and they're using math and stuff like that to solve problems or whatever. But they'll occasionally ride on like, you know, data boards or something like that, because it's, you know, it's a computer. So they're using computer lingo, and it reminded me of that, which made me laugh because I was imagining Superman in an episode of Cyber Chase, which would be very entertaining.
Sweet.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the one that made me giggle, and usually the ones that make me giggle are the ones that win my favorite moment. That definitely was it. What did you have for your top three?
At number three, and I have to just kind of go through it again to remind myself, but at number three, I had Deathstroke Inc. number 12. Again, solid stuff, and I think Ed Brisson has such a great, I feel like a broken record at this point, but I think Ed Brisson has such a great voice for Deathstroke and capturing what really makes him Deathstroke. At number two, I had Action Comics, number 1046. You know, just a solid penultimate chapter, but one that definitely has me hyped for War World Apocalypse next week. But at number one, should be no surprise, echoing you, I had Detective Comics, number 1063. Just another excellent installment in this Gotham Nocturne story, and it just has me so excited for what the future of this run on Detective Comics is going to hold. My favorite moment, however, for as much as I talked about how I loved Detective, actually comes from Deathstroke Inc., because I'm a sucker for this costume. And when I saw it, like my face lit up, and I remember the artist Dexter Soy had posted like a black and white version of it on his Instagram, and I was like, I cannot wait to see until this has colors. But it's the second page in Deathstroke Inc. Where it's Ollie, and he has his bow aimed at Deathstroke, and he's in the classic, you know, 70s attire, and it was so good. It was like, it's like something I would love to have on a poster, you know. And I hope there's a way I can find
the one where he's sitting there with the arrow drawn back.
Yeah, yeah, and he's like partly in shadow.
Yeah.
Oh, so just so gorgeous. Man. Yeah, and I'm such a sucker for that costume, and that was like, we lost Neil Adams not too long ago, but it's so great to know that his legacy is still living on. Because you look at art like this, and you just know like, all of that was drawn from Neil. So great.
Oh, yes. 100%.
If I can find a way to blow up this panel and make it a poster, I absolutely will. But I saw that and I was like, this is it. So that was my favorite moment. So yeah, good stuff there. But unfortunately, I am detecting something kind of nasty, kind of stinky in the air, which unfortunately means it is time for
the biggest thinker.
Oh, that's nasty.
Well, Cleveland, indeed. I think that all is based around opinion, but I'll take your word for it.
Yes, yes. But I think Cleveland is right in that something is kind of nasty around this area right here. So, Josh, I got to ask, what's stinking so much this week?
For me, man, Williamson did it to me again, and I'm starting to get real mad. He builds me up. He gets me excited. I start to think, you know what? Maybe he won't do it this time. And then it comes time for the landing, and it's like, did he even get to the ground? The Robin number 17, man, that's the one that's walking away with my biggest stinker winner this week.
As for me, and when I say this, trust me, it pains me to no end to even have to say this, and I think you might know where I'm going.
Actually, hold on.
Go for it.
I'm retracting my Robin, and I'm replacing it with the worst book that came out this week, and that's Justice League versus Legion of Superheroes.
Oh, well, seeing as how I didn't read that, I can't speak to that one. I assume it was not very good based on your tone.
Oh yeah, no, it's bad.
Yeah. I'm guessing as much. I literally, that book has come out and it's like wallpaper to me. Like I see it and I don't even acknowledge it. I have nothing to say. But yeah, no, as much as it pains me to say this one, because this book had consistently been my top, you know, book of the week almost every time it was coming out, but I just, mm-hmm. it would be unfair for me to not put it here, just I think because of how much I felt disappointed by the ending and what it could have been versus what it ultimately was. And that is The Swamp Thing number 16, which is like saying that is like telling your favorite child, in as much as you can have a favorite child, you know, I'm disappointed in you. Like turning to your child and saying, you let me down. Like it's so painful to have those words come out of my mouth, but I would be lying to myself if I said this wasn't the one that disappointed me. Robin was a disappointing ending, but I kind of expected that knowing just how fast the book was going to have to rush to its conclusion. But we knew this one was getting extended and I was hoping that it was going to have just a satisfying ending, even with the extension. And to me, at least, it really just didn't. So I'm sorry. It pains me. It really does. But The Swamp Thing is my biggest stinker this week. I don't even like saying that because it wasn't a stinker. It was disappointing to me.
The biggest letdown.
Yeah, the biggest letdown. Yeah, definitely not a stinker. And again, Justice League versus I almost said Justice League versus Suicide Squad. Justice League versus the Legion of Superheroes. I did not read that, so I can't say whether it was good or not. I think morbid curiosity is going to kick in one day, and I'll read the whole series and probably hate it as much as the rest of you guys seem to.
Yeah, there's a pretty good damn good chance of that. It's 5 issues in now, and it seems like it took us a year to get to it. But
yeah.
Wait for it to be a trade that you find at the used bookstore's dollar bin.
Which I'm sure you will. Actually, this will make you happy to hear. I was at my they have a used bookstore in downtown Ithaca. And I was there the other day picking up some stuff, and that's where I was able to score my copy of Far Sector. But I was not surprised to see lingering among the $5 to $6 books, Action Comics, Leviathan Rising, and Action Comics, what was it called? The something Mafia? Do you remember?
Was it the Shadow Mafia?
It's like, I'm looking it up right now.
Something really stupid. The Invisible Mafia. Like that
the Invisible Mafia. The Invisible Mafia. But yeah, if you're, if you just happen to be listening to this. Oh my God. No, go ahead.
That was a perfect example. The Invisible Mafia was a perfect example of one of Bendis's phenomenal ideas.
That's actually the only arc of Action that I like, which is crazy.
I feel like he completely blundered that one too, because what the hell is her name? The Red Mist? Is it just Red Mist?
Oh, yeah, I'm blanking on her name too. Yeah.
But talk about an amazing character you could have done so much with, and it was just like, yeah, we're just gonna bounce her against the wall again, see what happens. This is one person racquetball. It was a real letdown.
I mean, I know you were reading it as it was coming out, same as I was, and I remember, you know, there was all the hype that Bendis was taking over the super titles, and some people were very scared, some people were somewhat excited. Man of Steel was controversial, so there was a lot of strange energy around his first arc. And I remember reading Invisible Mafia and going, this actually isn't so bad. Like, it feels like it's playing to his strengths. You know, it's kind of more focused on the journalist side of Clark, yeah, which is great. And he seemed to have a handle on his supporting cast pretty well, with Jimmy and Perry, and maybe not so much with Lois, but it wasn't terrible. Not so much, Lois. But yeah, I remember, you know, it was that first arc, and I was like, okay, this could really be something special. And then we got to Leviathan Rising, and it was like, oh,
nope.
Oh, I see now. I see. And that's, I think it was after Leviathan Rising that I dropped the book, because I was just like, this is unreadable.
Mean you never read Sinmar of Sinmar, the Sinmar of Sinmar?
I did not read Sinmar, the Sinmar of Sinmar. I got to, I believe the arc was called Truth, where Superman reveals his public identity. I said, this is the stupidest shit ever. Who cares? And then I stopped reading the book. And that was that.
Perfect. You didn't need any more than that, and it's actually twice as much as what you really needed.
Yeah, I mean, I had no reason to continue reading that book, and I had no desire to continue reading that book either.
I don't blame you, man. Don't blame you. Ugh, but I guess that is about it, yeah?
It is, yeah. Again, kind of a shorter episode, but I think that is because Rob is not with us, keeping the energy going. But I hope we were able to entertain you as much as we possibly could. Once again, thank you very much for stopping by. We always appreciate you stopping by to listen to us and checking out our stuff. Remember, you can go to notarobotpodcasts.com to check out all of our stuff, as well as head over to buymeacoffee.com/NARA podcasts for the one-time donation or for a continued subscription for access to Discord, as well as all the other stuff that we have going on. Josh, Isaiah, and I just finished recording Horror Comics 2 Electric Boogaloo yesterday, which was incredibly exciting and a lot of fun.
Indeed we did.
And you can bet your bottom dollar that we will be doing another one. And there are a bunch of other great stuff or great shows that are available on the network that is worth your time. So with all that said, there's only one way that we say goodbye around here. Until next time.
Be good to yourself.
And don't be a robot. That was my best impression of Rob. I'm sorry. Rob, we need you here.